This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO, and I'm Teresa Mitchell. And today, I'm feeling mighty queer. You know, some days you just feel more queer than others, and I'm transgender. And I was feeling, well, you know, sometimes you just bust out of you. Like yesterday, I was doing my blue-collar job driving a bus, and somebody was mad at me. And when he got off the bus, he says, "Thank you, sir," really loudly, just to, you know, try to draw attention and try to make a big deal of the fact that I was trans. I said, "Thank you, madame. This guy looked like a Marine." And I thought he was going to punch me, but he thought better of it. But I was feeling mighty queer. And I'm still feeling queer. And it's a good thing because this is a very special week in the city of Portland, Oregon. This week is, well, let me lay on the proclamation that tells you what week this is. Whereas Walt Curtis has been cited as Portland's unofficial poet laureate for several decades, and whereas Walt Curtis wrote the novella Malanoche, which is adapted into the eponymous 1985 feature film that launched the directorial career of Gus Van Sant, and whereas Malanoche has been translated and published in both French and Italian editions, and Walt's prose and poetry have appeared in dozens of prestigious publications, and whereas Walt Curtis has been featured many times in film, I'm skipping ahead, co-founded the Oregon Cultural Heritage Commission, and whereas Walt Curtis suffered major losses of creative work and personal effects in the tragic fire at Great Northwest Bookstore Sunday, May 2nd, 2010, and whereas civic-minded friends are uniting to stage benefit performances, film screenings, and an auction of fine art and literature to launch the Curtis Legacy Initiative to reestablish his personal studio and residence and consolidate his regional and international reputation, now therefore I, not meaning me, but Sam Adams wrote this. Now, therefore, I, Sam Adams, mayor of the city of Portland, and I might add the gay mayor, the city of Roses, do hereby proclaim the week of July 1st through 7th, 2010, which includes his birthday, July 4th, to be Walt Curtis Week in Portland, and encourage all residents to become familiar with Walt Curtis' contributions to the arts in Portland. And I think Walt is right here. Are you there, Walt? We'll try that again. We'll see if we can get him back in here. This is Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. Here's some typical reporting from NPR about the war in Afghanistan. Note the use of the word in the text I'm going to repeat here, the use of the word counterinsurgency and the concern over whether a certain strategy will succeed, that is, whether it will subject Afghans to the will of the Pentagon. Here's the quote, as I said, from NPR. General David Petraeus' nomination as top U.S. commander in Afghanistan comes at a critical time. June has been the deadliest month for the U.S.-led coalition in the nearly nine-year-old war. More than 90 foreign troops have been killed. Concerns are also increasing over what is seen as a faltering war effort and whether the new counterinsurgency strategy for Afghanistan will succeed. Petraeus' confirmation hearing Tuesday clearly showed that there are high expectations for the four-star general not only to seamlessly assume command in Afghanistan but to quickly try to salvage the war effort there, end quote. So you do get some useful information out of NPR. You know, the U.S. has been occupying, although they don't use that word, for 9 years, twice as long as U.S. involvement in World War II, and 90 soldiers have died this month. So how many people have died trying to resist the invasion of U.S. troops, and how many people have died just for being in a country that's been invaded, bombed, occupied, and shot to rags by the U.S. military? You won't find that in this NPR article. No, the question to be raised is within a proscribed limit, which, though unstated, is obvious. It's something like, there will be no questioning of the war itself, no recognition of the legitimacy of those who defend their land against invaders, nor is the process merely to be described as by a professional journalist without an obvious stake in the outcome. Instead, we have the vague phrase, concerns are also increasing, you know, notice the passive voice there, over what is seen as a faltering war effort and whether the new counterinsurgency strategy for Afghanistan will succeed. Who is concerned? In NPR propaganda, it's assumed you're concerned. You, a U.S. citizen, are presumed to be a supporter of this bloody, cowardly, and illegal invasion. The more you listen to NPR, day in and day out, the more likely you are to slide into this inverted cone of discussion. Are we doing the war right? Are we succeeding? Do the tactics work? Should there be a new tactic? And once you fall into that trap, how hard it is to think rationally, to come up with the real questions. How can we stop this war? When will all the troops return? Should war crimes trials be held internationally for the war planners or just within our system? Should we move towards massive civil disobedience, work stoppages, or just demonstrations for now? How much should we pay in war reparations when we conclude this illegal disgusting, cowardly war? Those are hard questions to find in NPR coverage. Yep, today is Walt Curtis Day. KBOO Portland. According to a Wikipedia article totting up the available figures, and these would be the very conservative figures, the U.S. has killed between 13 and 32,000 people in Afghanistan since the November 2001 invasion, which, as you will recall, followed upon loud blaming by U.S. officials for the airline hijackings. We were to believe that the attack was like Pearl Harbor, an attack by one sovereign nation upon another, and that this time it was not Japan but Afghanistan that had attacked. Never mind that it was Saudis. Yet in all this time there was never been a proper trial using crime scene evidence and witnesses that blames the Afghan people for the hijackings. That's the conceit, basically. It's like, these al-Qaeda people were being coddled by Afghanistan, therefore we get to blow up Afghanistan. No trial. Perhaps a few recall that it was largely Saudi citizens blamed for piloting the death planes, though it's clear to anyone examining the evidence that the New York buildings were packed with sequentially detonated thermite, that the whole stunt was a false flag setup intended to give fascist powers to the U.S. secret police agencies and to the Pentagon and the presidency. And David Ray Griffin has written a new book on it. Here's an excerpt from his article in Global Research. What was the motive for the invasion of Afghanistan? He writes, this conclusion that Afghanistan should be attacked is reinforced by reports indicating that the U.S. had made the decision to invade Afghanistan 2 months. I'm sorry, the conclusion that the attack was already on the agenda is reinforced by reports indicating that the U.S. had made the decision to invade Afghanistan 2 months before the 9/11 attacks. At least part of the background to this decision was the United States' long-term support for UNICAL's proposed pipeline, which would transport oil and natural gas from the Caspian Sea region to the Indian Ocean through Afghanistan and Pakistan. This project had been stymied through the 90s because of the civil war that had been going on in Afghanistan since the Soviet withdrawal in 89. In the mid-90s, the U.S. government had supported the Taliban with the hope that its military strength would enable it to unify the country and provide a stable government, which would protect the pipeline. You know, it's the our bastards argument. By late 1990s, however, the Clinton administration had given up on the Taliban. When the Bush administration came to power, it decided to give the Taliban one last chance. They're just friendly with the Taliban. During a four-day meeting in Berlin in July 2001, representatives of the Bush administration insisted that the Taliban must create a government of national unity by sharing power with factions friendly to the United States. The U.S. representative reportedly said, quote, either you accept our offer of a carpet of gold or we bury you under a carpet of bombs, end quote. After the Taliban refused this offer, U.S. officials told a former Pakistani foreign secretary that military action against Afghanistan would go ahead before the snows started falling in Afghanistan by the middle of October at the latest. Remember, this is all before 9/11. And indeed, given the fact that the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon occurred when they did, the U.S. military was able to mobilize to begin its attack on Afghanistan by October 7th. It appears, therefore, that the United States invaded Afghanistan for reasons far different from the official rationale, according to which we were there to capture or kill Osama bin Laden. End quote. That's the end of the David Ray Griffin quote. And maybe that's why NPR can get away with handcuffed media coverage of the Afghan war. We're supposed to forget the cause, forget history, forget the lies, and just get on with the business of mass murder. Allow me, please, to indulge a moment of truth. U.S. wars are imperial corporate crimes. The wars must stop now, and war reparations must be paid to our victims. All troops must return. We have no right to occupy other people's countries, destroy their way of life, and murder their citizens. Stop the wars. My personal opinion. Stop the wars. Certainly would like to hear that in the streets again. Michael Snyder, writing for Pravda. I'm changing topics slightly here. More imperial wars on the horizon. There is an article about the saber rattling versus Iran. And he's noting that there could be dire results. But before I give that, we're going to try again to contact Walt Curtis. KBOO to Walt Curtis. Are you there, Walt Curtis?
Teresa, I all love right. you. I feel queer, too. The mayor is gay, and the gay poet gets 15 minutes of fame.
Teresa. Excellent. It's an excellent thing.
It's amazing. I've spent 38 years on community radio. You know, this whole thing, as far as I'm concerned, is not about me. It's about us. It's about... And I hate the bombs bursting in air. You know, this country was born in violence, and it still continues. And so I really hate the 4th of July, but I love KBOO. I love community. you know, generations come and go, and it's not about one ego. So I just want to thank everyone in the whole damn city, wherever they are, and in out in Radio Land for all that's been given me, you know, so.
And you've always stood for peace. So maybe July 4th can be Interdependence Day, and we can look bravely into this landscape that's been created for us by the banksters and the warriors and decide to stand together and to make groups and make unions.
You know, you make the hackles up on the back of my neck, you know, that we have a venue to talk to the world like no one else does. And you do it so well, Teresa. So I just want to mention the event, and you probably have. I had technology. I hate cell phones. But mine just
well, I've announced the proclamation, but I haven't given your appearances, which include July 1st. That's today at Burbadi's.
Yeah, tonight there will be poets, including the poet laureate Paul Ann Peterson and Tom Spanbauer, a very queer, wonderful writer, and myself and my co-host on the Talking Earth, Barbara Lamorticello.
So, Barbara!
Come out, but, you know, you don't have to come if you don't like poetry. And Glenn Moore and Nancy King will be there. And tomorrow there'll be something at that Beer Bodies Plant tonight. And tomorrow there'll be something at Dante's. But listen, support the station. Support the fishermen in the Gulf. I mean, use your money that way if you want. Don't worry about me, because I'm surrounded by love. People have been so gracious to me. And KBU has been so gracious to me down through the years. And if I drop dead right now, what else, you know, could I do in my lifetime? So, Teresa, carry on. Keep the spirit going, okay?
Thanks so much for calling in. By the way, that's...
Okay, I appreciate the opportunity to send my love and thank everyone for their affection. And I'm grateful. I'm grateful to Sam Adams. And July 4th, no more bombs bursting in air. Thank you, Teresa.
We love you, Walt. We love you. Also, July 2nd at Dante's, July 6th at Cinema 21, a remastered 35mm screening of Mala and Noche. That'll be $10. And by the way, if you want to support arts in this town, one way you can do it is just go down to the Wells Fargo Bank and say, take me to your leader. No, say, I would like to leave money for Walt Curtis. And they will find the Walt Curtis Fund. And people are doing that. And that keeps us from, you know, from going into any further space of time with a basically homeless poet laureate. We can't have that. So go on down to Wells Fargo, will you? Just hoof it down there and they'll tell you how to do it. As each day passes, Michael Snyder writes, the war in the Middle East seems increasingly likely. The truth is that Israel will never allow Iran to develop nuclear weapons, and Iran is absolutely determined to continue developing a nuclear program. So right now, Israel and Iran are engaged in a really bizarre game of nuclear chicken, and neither side is showing any sign of blinking. In fact, even prominent world leaders are now openly stating that it's basically inevitable that Israel is going to strike Iran. For example, Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi recently made the stunning admission that the G8 nations absolutely believe that Israel will attack Iran, but a conflict between Israel and Iran will not just affect the Middle East, it would have staggering implications for the rest of the globe. Now I'm going to depart from that article, which is, as I said, from Pravda, and comment that it takes the trope that we're all supposed to accept that it's illegitimate for Iran to take up nuclear weapons against Israel, forgetting, of course, that Israel is chock full of nuclear weapons with delivery systems and has been very militaristically threatening towards its neighbors, is not known for its cooperation with neighbors. And I'm supposed to ignore the hypocrisy of that position. Now, I'm not really happy that anyone's building nuclear weapons, includes Iran, but you know, they're under nuclear threat, so what can I say? But returning to the Russian article, so just what would a war between Israel and Iran mean for the world economy? And this is the part I wanted to get to because, as I was saying, this is the time for you to form your gang. And that means having direct, transparent economic discussions with everyone you care about, all your friends, bring in friends that you trust. You need to form a gang. You'd better, because double dip is a pretty mild word for what I think we're about to face in terms of economic conditions. But there are seven potential economic effects that Michael Snyder lists here. First, the price of oil would skyrocket. One of the first things a war with Iran would do is that it would severely constrict or even shut down oil shipments through the Strait of Hormuz. Considering the fact that 20% of the world's oil flows through the Strait of Hormuz, world oil markets would instantly be plunged into a frenzy. The greed heads. Well, he didn't write the part about the greed heads. In fact, some analysts believe that oil prices would rise to $250 per barrel. So are you ready to pay $8 or $10 for a gallon of gasoline? What do you think that would do to the U.S. economy? The truth is that every single transaction we make every single day is influenced by the price of oil. The price of oil suddenly doubles or triples. That would absolutely devastate the already very fragile U.S. economic system. It's 20 minutes after 9. You're listening to KBOO. This is Press Watch with Teresa Mitchell, the tranny with an attitude. I could say TM. That's my initials, Teresa Mitchell. Number two, fear would explode and world financial markets should Iran be attacked. Even without a war, the dominant force in the world financial markets in 2010 is fear. We are already seeing unprecedented volatility in financial markets around the globe, and there's nothing like a war to turn fear into a full-fledged panic. And what happens when the panic grips financial markets? What happens is they crash. Third item, world trade would instantly seize up. Once upon a time, the economies of the world were relatively self-contained, so a war in one area would not necessarily wreck economies all over the globe. But all that has changed now. Today, the economies of virtually every nation are highly interdependent. That has some advantages, but it also has a lot of disadvantages. If a war with Iran did break out, nations all over the globe would start taking sides, and world trade would seize up. The global flow of goods and services would be severely interrupted. That would be enough to push many nations around the world into a full-blown depression. I want to depart from that text again. And that's something you really don't hear about in the U.S. media. Everyone's just not real happy, despite what you might have heard, with the idea that the U.S. and Israel are bullying Iran. And bullying is the right word. Iran's very small economically, militarily compared to the U.S. This is, well, I'm sorry to use the word again, but it's just another case of being cowardly in a collective basis. I'm disgusted with the continuation of imperial policy, and that's a big reason, because it is cowardly, and I would like to hear the C word used more often when it comes to U.S. wars. They're disgusting. Disgusting for that reason. And, well, talk to a Brazilian. I suppose talking to one Brazilian wouldn't give you much of a statistical sample, but look at what Brazil has to say about bullying Iran. You know, it's ugly and people know it. Anyway, getting to reason number four, military spending would escalate even if the U.S. was not pulled directly into a conflict between Israel and Iran. Ha ha! With our, departing from the text with our military surrounding the place, and more on that in a minute. Returning to the text, there is little doubt that the U.S. would be spending a lot of money and resources to support Israel and to build up military assets in the region in case a wider war broke out. The U.S. has already spent somewhere in the neighborhood of $1 trillion on the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. If war does break out with Iran, the amount of money the U.S. government could be forced to spend could be absolutely staggering. What's that? We don't have money for schools? Returning to the text, the truth is that the U.S. is already drowning in debt. At this point, the U.S. government is over $13 trillion in debt. That's $13,000 billion in debt. And another Middle East war is certainly not going to help things. Reason number five, Russia would greatly benefit, blah, 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 blah. I don't really care about that part. Number six, massive inflation, a huge jump in the price of oil, and dramatically increased military spending by U.S. government would most definitely lead to price inflation. We would probably see a dramatic rise in interest rates as well. In fact, it is likely that if war with Iran does break out, we would see a return of stagflation, a situation where prices are rapidly escalating, but economic growth as a whole is either flat or declining. And number seven, the price of gold would go through the roof. Don't really know if that's true. But, a lot of people say that. So there you go. Could it be, as the writer says, departing from that text now, that economic turmoil could resume merely with the expansion of U.S. imperial wars? My guess is that the so-called recovery is fragile enough that such an event would be sufficient to trigger the inevitable. The U.S. is set up right now to bomb Iran from aircraft and ships associated with the USS Eisenhower and the USS Truman battle groups, which are today together in the Persian Gulf. And, supposedly the Truman is relieving USS Eisenhower. But we won't know that until Friday, tomorrow. And so it's worth looking, Googling USS Eisenhower and see if it actually heads back to home port. If it doesn't, that's bad news. Imagine a map of Iran with a clock at the center. You will find big buildups of U.S. troops and equipment, not only in the Gulf, but at 5 o'clock, there's Pakistan and its collaboration with the U.S. and, those drones and all the stuff that U.S. has in Pakistan at 3 o'clock. Afghanistan's U.S. air bases looked up there at noon, Turkmenistan at 11, U.S. troops, Georgia at 9, U.S. troops, Georgia is north, so that would also be at noon. And then over at 9 o'clock, the massive imperial presence in Iraq. At 8 o'clock, Bahrain, the country is utterly surrounded by U.S. armor. And there's more and more preparations. This is from an Israeli source. Egypt allowed at least one Israeli and 11 American warships to pass through the Suez Canal. A few days ago, as an Iranian flotilla approaches Gaza, Egypt closed the canal to protect the ships with thousands of soldiers, according to the British-based Arabic language newspaper Al-Quds. One day prior to the report on Saturday, the Voice of Israel government radio reported that the Egyptian government denied an Israeli request not to allow the Iranian flotilla to use the Suez Canal to reach Gaza in violation of the Israeli sea embargo. International agreements require Egypt to keep the Suez open even for warships, but the armada led by the USS Truman, with 5,000 sailors and marines, was the largest in years. Egypt closed the canal to fishing and other boats as the armada moved through the strategic passageway that connects the Red Sea and Mediterranean seas. So there's a possibility, worse than, I'd say half a year ago, that there is war with Iran afoot. Certainly would be a handy diversion from certain oil spills, wouldn't it? And now let's talk about the robust recovery that we've all heard about. This is from the Boston Globe. Unable to deliver more stimulus spending for President Obama, Democrats in Congress are trying at least to restore jobless benefits for 1.3 million laid-off workers. Democrats in both the House and Senate plan to vote on bills today that would extend unemployment benefits through the end of November for people who have been laid off for long stretches. House Democrats postponed a vote scheduled for yesterday. Democratic leaders were hoping to pass the extension before Congress goes on a week-long Independence Day recess. Without an extension, every week, a new 200,000 of the nearly 7 million people who have been without a job for at least 6 months will lose their unemployment benefits. At least 1.3 million have already lost benefits, including about 40,000 in Massachusetts since that last extension ran out at the end of May, according to state and federal labor officials. Here's a quote from Harry Reid. We have a basic responsibility to help our constituents respond to emergencies, end quote. He also said, we have a fundamental obligation not to deny them the help they need when they need it the most, end quote. Congressional Democrats, according to this article from the Boston Globe, began the year with an aggressive agenda of passing a series of bills designed to create jobs. Only one has become law, offering tax breaks to companies that hire unemployed workers. Others stalled as lawmakers, often hearing from angry voters, became wary of adding to the national debt, which stands at $13 trillion. Obama has urged lawmakers to spend about $50 billion to help states pay for Medicaid programs and to avoid teacher layoffs, but Democrats in Congress have been unable to come up with the votes, end quote. Now, this news of denial of piddly unemployment benefits is doubly noxious when you consider that the TARP bailout plus the lesser-known federal and treasury bailouts for the super-rich, for the bankster class, amounted to trillions of dollars and are being considered yet again. There seems to be plenty of money to keep the super rich comfortable and boost their profits, plenty of cash for imperial warmongering, while schools decide whether to cut their PE classes or shorten their staffs or school years. But of course, this is no mistake, but merely represents the victory of the fascist owning class. Their occupying army, the police, are ready to evict you and your family today. Had a little bit more information on how the Baltic Dry Index is tanking, and if I may translate that real quickly, it means bad economic signs, not a recovery. So, sorry to load you with the bad news, but that's how it is this week. And once again, it's Walt Curtis Week. Check it out. Listen to KBOO for more details. At 9:30, Per Fogering speaks with Tom Englehart, creator of the TomDispatch.com website, and they discuss Tom's recent article on America's use of pilotless drones. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. At 10:15, Flashpoints. At 11, Between the Covers, and 11:30 on Black Book Talk, the guest is children's author Renee Watson, who will discuss her two newly released books, What Mama Taught Me and A Place Where Hurricanes Happen, A Tale of Katrina, as children saw it, all here on KBOO Portland.